Evening to everybody. Welcome once again on a summer's evening to Amnesty's monthly membership call for July. Hello again to all you Amnesty members, member leaders, those who are calling back. Let me extend a very special welcome this evening to any of you new guests or young leaders who may be calling in for the first time. And I just want you to know we're really happy to have you here. As always, our intent with these calls is to provide a forum for an open communication between our members, groups, member leaders, and to provide a space for member-to-member communication and sharing of your knowledge. So we're glad to have you be a part of this tonight. Now, in the past few months, we have focused our calls on counteracting aspects of the Muslim and refugee ban. Now, while some of these provisions have been rolled back temporarily, we're now facing a worsening climate for refugees and for those seeking asylum in the U.S., most of whom are fleeing untenable situations in their home countries. So in this call, we'll outline the changes that are being proposed by the administration to limit refugees and to cut funding. We'll explore some of the circumstances causing the influx of refugees at our southern border, and we'll also detail legislative advocacy strategies that Amnesty has planned in the next few months to neutralize these changes, strategies to help keep our doors open. So to introduce ourselves, my name is Edwin Gore. I am membership coordinator at Amnesty International in the Member Leadership and Training Unit. I started out as an Amnesty volunteer in the 80s. I worked with Group 9 in Manhattan, which actually is still going. And then soon after that, I joined staff, and I've been working closely with member leaders since then. So let's get started with this. Let me take a moment to introduce you to our speakers for this evening. Each one provides a unique perspective and special expertise on our refugee and asylum work. So I'm really happy to have them here tonight. They are Stephanie Malini, Member Advocacy Coordinator at AIUSA, Larry Leduca, who's AIUSA Country Specialist for El Salvador, and he's also State Legislative Coordinator for New Jersey, Denise Bell, who's our Senior Campaigner in our Refugee and Migrant Rights Program at AIUSA, and finally, Ben Steele, who's State Legislative Coordinator for Arizona. So before we begin, let me ask you two requests, ground rules, for everyone calling in. So when you speak, and I'm hearing some noise here, please remember to mute your phone when you're not speaking. So if everyone could take a moment and mute your phone, that would help us all. And avoid using a speakerphone. It doesn't help us. And remember to speak directly into the phone when you speak. So when you do speak up, if you share, please state your name, where you're calling from, and any role that you may play in Amnesty. Okay, so as long as we're good with that, and everyone has muted their phone, we'll get started. So just to let you know, we will allow any time for questions and comments that you might have during the conversation. So please do feel free to share. So, Denise, please introduce yourself, provide some background, and we can begin.
Thank you, Ed. And I just want to say I'm really thrilled to be on this call and be talking about the Refugee Rights Campaign, which is also known as the I Welcome Campaign. But a little about me, I am the Senior Campaigner for Refugee and Migrant Rights. I have been involved with Amnesty in both a member leader and staff capacity since 2004. Most recently, I was a country specialist for Sudan. But I came to Amnesty most recently from the Department of Justice, where I worked on the New York Immigration Court. So I know asylum seekers and their stories and the law firsthand because I wrote the decisions for the judges. But I've been working on refugee rights since the mid-1990s when I went to Croatia after the Dayton Peace Accord and helped with the UN-sponsored volunteer project dealing with refugees and internally displaced persons. So I'm just going to give a snapshot right now on what the campaign is working on and give a preview of where we're going. I know that we've done, the last few calls have focused on the refugee and Muslim ban, and that's been a standalone crisis response that's intersected with the I Welcome campaign, but we're going to be folding that work into the I Welcome campaign. So right now for July, August, and into September, our theme is keep U.S. doors open to people fleeing violence. And we have three major categories of work. One is what we're calling Save the U.S. Refugee Program. So the refugee ban is threatening to decimate the refugee admission program, and a series of laws is threatening to do that and funding proposals. So our first goal is not to let Trump implement the refugee ban. Right now where that stands is on October 10th, the Supreme Court is going to hear the case challenging the ban. Right now, the case is making its way through the lower courts, through Hawaii and the Ninth Circuit. And the ban has been partially lifted, but not entirely. So refugees who, for now, refugees who have family here, close family, can get in. But refugees who have formal relationships with one of nine resettlement agencies cannot. And so what that means is that there are 26,000 refugees who were slated to come here, that were already approved to live in the U.S., be resettled here. We don't know what number of those will meet the new criteria. Close family are considered grandparents, grandchildren, brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and cousins, as well as parents, siblings, and that includes step-siblings and half-siblings, fiancés, and more immediate nuclear family members. We don't know when refugees will start to arrive. We don't know how many will arrive. Right now, more than 50,000 have arrived. But again, we have 26,000 who are directly impacted by this ban because they were approved to come here and live, and now they're stuck abroad. So what we are doing is calling on Congress members to express their opposition to this ban and to support bills that seek to nullify the ban. And Stephanie will be speaking about that, how we're trying to do that through our August lobby days. We're also looking at the budget. There are budget proposals to basically limit funding for only 50,000 refugees for resettlement next year. So we have two asks around this. One is keep the funding levels as the same as they've been in the past years. So don't cut funds for refugees as the administration has proposed. Don't eliminate the emergency fund for refugees, which the administration has proposed, and that's called IRMA. But also support the resettlement of 75,000 refugees. So we are asking our Congress members to say to the administration they support the resettlement of 75,000 refugees, and they support the funding for 75,000 refugees. The president wants to resettle only 50,000, and that's the lowest goal ever set. And so we are seeing both a shrinking of the program through a budget proposal, but also through the ban, which is decimating the program and slowing it down through vetting, through not allowing people in. So we are focusing right now on saving the U.S. refugee program. I will say that we're working on a campaign strategy for the fall that's looking at this in a very serious way that will run over the next year on how we can save the program and ensure that over the course of the next year, next September, when the president sets the admission numbers, that it's at least 75,000. We are in an existential, there is an existential threat to this program that no one's ever witnessed, and we will really be investing and digging in and preserving that program. The second goal that we have is to stop the criminalization of asylum seekers. There have been a number of bills that have come up in the House that our advocacy department has worked very hard to defeat. And by defeat, we mean that they don't make it to the floor, they don't make it out of committee, or if they do make it to the floor and they are passed, that when they get to the Senate, that we have champions there who will defeat it. And just today, we were looking at a markup of a very, very, very extreme anti-asylum bill called the Asylum Reform and Border Protection Act. And it's a punitive bill that basically severely mined access to asylum and strips a lot of protections for unaccompanied children and makes it very hard for people who have been persecuted on account of, let's say, gang violence to get protection here. So that is more of an advocacy level, but we will be calling on members to take targeted action when a bill comes to vote. The other is that as part of access to asylum, we want to stop the criminalization of it, but we also want to end the detention of families and individuals seeking asylum. So we're looking at the DHS, the budget for the Department of Homeland Security. There's a budget proposal for $4.5 billion for enforcement, and $1.5 billion of that goes towards detention beds and other enforcement measures, such as deportation. And already, we have the largest immigration detention system in the world, and this budget proposes to expand our detention system even further, so more families, more asylum seekers will be detained. And so what we see through these policies, these budgets, these executive orders is an attempt, a very real attempt, and unfortunately it's creeping up and becoming more successful, to close our borders and to criminalize asylum and refugees. So we're fighting on both the refugee and asylum front a lot right now through the budget and defeating some bills.
Okay. Is there anything more, or do we have questions for Denise?
I'm happy to take questions. I can go into a lot more granular detail. I was trying to give a big picture, but people want numbers or bill numbers or budget numbers. I'm happy to give them.
Any comments? Questions?
Ben from Arizona.
Yeah, go Ben.
I'm curious, would it be possible to get a listing of those through email? I don't have a lot of ability to keep them down right now, but I would like to see what measures we should be looking for coming up.
Do you mean like bills, or do you mean?
Bills and budgetary measures.
Sure. Well, actually, that's Stephanie's doing that next part. That's exactly what Stephanie's going to do, is the legislative advocacy on these issues.
Yeah, and Ben, and just as a note for everyone on the phone, I'll be talking about this in a little bit, but we will have issue briefs like we do on all of our legislative priorities that we put out to our members, and we'll have those issue briefs for you all so you can get those into the hands of your members of Congress.
Yes, so those will be following, those will be coming out after this, and they will be on our website. We're finalizing them right now. And there will be three of them. One is an update on our current refugee and Muslim ban issue brief. One will be on immigration detention and its impact on asylum seekers and on family detention. We're looking specifically at Berks and the long-term detention of children there and their parents. And then the third will be on proposed cuts to the refugee program in both numbers and funding and foreign assistance. So those will be the three different issue briefs that will lay this out.
Mm-hmm. Denise, do you just want to do a little explanation on Berks? I mean, you mentioned it, and some people may not be entirely familiar.
Absolutely. So when we are focusing on access to asylum, what we are focusing on is really stopping the expansion of detention of asylum seekers. And we're focusing first on families, on family detention. There are only three locations in the United States where families are detained, and this is children and their parents. One is in Pennsylvania and at Berks, and two are in Texas, one at Dilley and one at Carnes. The two in Texas are run by private contractors, Civic Cares and GEO, GEO Cares and Civic. And then the one in Pennsylvania is run by the municipality, and it's leased out to DHS. I think that's how the structure works. We have an urgent action on four detained families there, three of the Berks kids. These children have been detained for over 600 days. They've not been charged with a crime. The only thing they've done is come here, and their mothers asked for asylum. But they have been detained this entire time. One of them has learned to walk in jail. And so we are urging, we are campaigning to free them while their court case proceeds, but we're also looking to shut down facilities like Burke's and the other two detention centers so that the practice of family detention is ended altogether. We had started a campaign on Shutdown Burke's where we targeted Ivanka Trump, and this is a global campaign because she has been appointed to the White House, and she's built her political career on child welfare and the welfare of working families. And it's a ask to say, come visit Burke's, push this policy, a humane policy of not detaining children. We are transitioning to a more state-based model for the end family detention, and we'll have more news to deliver in the next few weeks about where we're going. But we will be delivering postcards. There's a digital postcard action. We will be delivering postcards to Ivanka Trump in a series of coordinated stunts around the world on her birthday, which is October 30th.
Okay, great, thanks. So, I mean, part of this is the upcoming proposals are expanding immigration detention. Is that right?
Yeah, we want to prevent the expansion.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Exactly.
That's sort of what we're looking at. And I think part of Stephanie's lobbying has to do with the funding of that, so we will get into that. Does anyone else have a question for Denise or a comment? Going once? Twice? Okay. All right. Well, Denise will be on the call if you have any other questions for her, and, you know, she can help us along here. So let's move on. Stephanie, could you introduce yourself and talk about the lobby actions we have planned?
Sure thing, Ed. Thank you. Hi, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephanie Malini. I am the Member Advocacy Coordinator in the Member Leadership and Training Unit. And I've been on staff with Amnesty just a little bit less than a year. I think end of August is going to be my year anniversary. And it's just been obviously a quite intense period here. We have been really pushing our legislative advocacy strategies, especially at the grassroots level, because that is where we feel that we can really make an impact. And so that's what I'm here to talk to you all tonight. And thank you, Denise, for that overview of the incredible work that the campaign is doing, and for sort of outlining all of our asks to Congress that we have on this. And thanks to everyone for having me here tonight. I'm excited about some of the ways that we can take immediate action for refugees and asylum seekers. So I'm going to be speaking to you all tonight about our August lobby action, and that's going to focus on President Trump's proposed budget, as well as continuing our work on the Muslim and refugee ban. So right now we're in the midst of what the United Nations has called the greatest humanitarian crisis since 1945, and the Trump administration's budget for the fiscal year 2018 poses a significant threat to human rights worldwide. Trump's proposed budget slashes funding for refugee programs and foreign aid, leaving millions at risk and abdicating the United States' role as a leader in refugee and humanitarian assistance. The proposed budget also increases funding for detention and deportation of vulnerable men, women, and children seeking safety. But thankfully, Congress and not the president has the power of the purse. So one of the most effective things that you can do to oppose the president's proposed budget is to get out and meet with your members of Congress. Our asks for this August will be what Denise has outlined, you know, support the resettlement of at least 75,000 refugees, keep funding the refugee program, don't cut funding for the international affairs budget, reject proposals to increase funding for detention facilities that hold mothers and children that are seeking asylum, reject the president's funding request for billions more in border enforcement. And like I said, in addition to all these asks, which will be outlined in issue briefs, we're still asking people to lobby their members of Congress to speak out against on the Muslim and refugee ban. So why we want you to lobby on these issues in August? The House of Representatives will begin its month-long recess beginning July 31st. And the Senate has delayed the start of its recess until the third week of August, but they will still be having a August recess. So that means that your members of Congress will be in their home districts, making next month the perfect time to get out to meet with your elected officials. And you can do this by attending a town hall, scheduling an in-person lobby visit with them, or even just by dropping by the office. We actually had a successful action over the July 4th recess where we asked activists, instead of to make sort of a typical lobby visit where you schedule a visit with your members, to just drop by the office, drop off these issue briefs, drop off our materials, you know, take a picture, tweet about it, and that went really well. And it can be a little bit less intimidating than making the full-on lobby visit. However, we still would really want you to do a full-on lobby visit. But either one of those things would be great for August. So if you're interested in joining us to lobby this August recess, you can sign up by clicking the link that was sent out in the earlier email today. It came through the email that had the call information for this call. Click that link, and you can sign up to take action with us. And we'll get you materials you need to effectively lobby your members of Congress. That'll include issue briefs, tips on attending town halls, and then also some tips on lobbying generally. And the issue briefs are going to focus on the priorities I mentioned tonight. They're going to be great tools for you to understand the issues, but ultimately they're intended for you to leave with your members of Congress. So how do you get out to meet with your members of Congress this August? One thing that we want you to do is to try to get to a town hall. I should say that our goal at town halls is not to protest. We'd be there to convey public concern and help persuade our members of Congress to do the right thing. And the best way to do this at a town hall or event is to be able to ask a question of the senator or House member during the event. So, what's that? Sorry. Okay. I thought someone had a question. All right. So on this call tonight, I'd like to give you some concrete suggestions for how to approach town halls and take advantage of the opportunity, because it is sort of a unique event. It's a little bit different than, you know, going and scheduling a meeting with your member of Congress or dropping off materials or even just making a phone call. So when you go to a town hall, you want to get to the event early. There might be limits on crowd size, or there might be a line to get into the event, so you want to get there as early as you can. Introduce yourself to as many of the senator or House member staff as you can before the event starts. You know, thank them for holding the event, and you know, thank them for reaching out to the community. That's actually so important now, especially with so many members of Congress who have stopped holding town hall events. You know, when you're there, make it clear to them that this is something that you value and that the community values. You know, sit near the front and appear engaged throughout. That's always useful. And then as soon as the floors open up for questions, raise your hand and try to catch the eye of the staffers that you've met previously. So that's why you are introducing yourself to staff earlier. It's so they recognize you. They're more likely to call on you. And if you're not called on, don't shout questions out. You know, we want you to be recognized in, you know, a manner that's professional, and we want you to be able to ask questions officially. Like I said, these aren't like protest events. We are being respectful during them. And so ask your question in a calm and serious manner. And then after you've asked the question, stay standing, and you know, if the House or Senate member doesn't fully answer it, you can ask a follow-up question because they might try to, you know, get around actually having to answer the question, which is pretty typical. And if you don't get to ask a question, if for some reason you can't get in line, there's a ton of people. I know that a lot of these town halls have been sort of at capacity by lots of different activists working on healthcare. So if, you know, you can't get a word in edgewise, stay after the event, try to catch staff, and bring along the issue brief that we give to you. Not only will they be good, you know, tools for you to learn about the issues, but then you can pass on those issue briefs to staff at the event. And like I said, many of members of Congress aren't having town halls these days, even though we would really like you to try to get out to the ones that they are having in August. And you can check to see if there's any town halls going on in your area by going to websites like townhallproject.com. And on that website, you just put in your zip code, and it'll pull up the town halls that are going to be happening in your area. And I have found that they don't always have all the town halls, so if you want to make sure, you can try calling your local offices and the district offices and asking them, you know, are you going to be having any town halls this August recess? And if you're a constituent, they're usually really happy to tell you about any town halls or events that are happening. Sometimes members of Congress aren't having town hall events, and instead they're having office hours. So that would be a time that you could just drop by the office to drop off materials, try to get your congressperson's ear about the budget or the Muslim and refugee ban, hopefully both. And, so that's another avenue to consider. So you can always look on your member's website, and that's a great place to find the information as well. And so if they're not having town hall, they're not having office hours, you can still, you know, do the good old-fashioned schedule a lobby visit. We'd still love for you to do that. And, so we can send you all this information, including the issue brief, tips on attending town halls and things like that, through the link I mentioned earlier, the one that came through as a reminder of this call today. And after you sign up, we'll also connect you with other activists in your state, including your state legislative coordinator. And while I'm on, I definitely have to plug the state legislative coordinator program. They're volunteers who work with staff and members to lobby members of Congress, state legislatures, other key officials to protect human rights. And legislative coordinators advise activists in their state on advocacy tactics and issues and build networks up to win legislative victories. So they're immensely important people to know in your state. We've got a couple on the call tonight. Hi, everyone. Huge shout-out to them and the work they've done, and also all of our other activists who have participated in these legislative advocacy strategies. If you'd like to get involved in our legislative advocacy work, August recess would be a great opportunity to do so. And before I go, one last thing, and I have to mention this. If you do take action with us, please let us know by going to amnestyusa.org/debrief. That's amnestyusa.org/debrief. I can't stress enough how important it is to let us know after you've taken action, because otherwise we don't know that you've done it. So fill out a debrief and take pictures if you can, and I'm excited for you all to participate in this action, because it's one of the best things that we can do to combat the president's agenda and his proposed budget. And so now I think I'm going to turn it over to Larry.
Okay.
I could take questions first.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Stephanie?
Yeah, sorry.
Before you go on, I just want to say, could everybody make sure that your phone is on mute? We're getting a little feedback here. So just check your phone, make sure you're on mute. And Stephanie, I just wanted to ask too, the sign up that is on the link, it's also available on the website, right?
It is. Right now, this is getting technical, but our short URL isn't working. So if I were to give you the link right now, it'd be sort of a lot of different numbers and letters. So the best way to do it right now is to go ahead and sign up through that link, but it can be found on the website.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. Any questions for Stephanie? Comments?
I have a question. This is Kit from Vermont.
Hi, Kit.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Good.
As the legislative coordinator for Vermont, could you just quickly give a nice little plug for people whose members of Congress tends to do the right thing? Like, we have very friendly members of Congress up here, but we still need to reach out to them. So if I don't want anyone to, you know, leave this meeting thinking, oh, wow, well, you know, I don't have to do this because my members of Congress are real friendly. Could you just give a plug to those of us who need that plug?
Exactly, Kit. Thank you so much. Great question. We definitely want to keep reaching out to the members of Congress who are doing all the right things. We want to make sure we get in touch with them to thank them, to let them know that they have our support, that we like what they're doing. That is just as important in maintaining that relationship and then also reinforcing that good behavior. But then as well, sometimes if you have a close enough relationship with the office, you can sort of use them to gather intel on how we can move other offices, who should we be talking to. So if your member of Congress is friendly, maintain that friendliness. Definitely reach out to them on this, and especially with some of this budget stuff, because that we do get into the numbers. We just want to make sure that everyone has the information that all of our asks as well.
And this is Denise. I just want to add to that particularly with the immigration enforcement issues, a lot of the asks right now have been focused around the wall in this $4.5 billion proposal. And that's important because from Amnesty's perspective, the wall could violate a number of human rights, from indigenous rights to access to asylum. But what we do know is that we've been working very hard to build up pressure in coalition on the detention beds. And this is much harder to get traction. And so what we know is that everything comes down to the Senate. But the Senate is not going to act and expend capital in certain areas if they don't see their House people doing it. So even if people have been supportive in general, pro-refugee, pro-asylum seeker, pro-immigrant, they need to hear that their action is necessary and we shouldn't assume it, because there are so many demands being put on people that it could be easier to not act because they only have so much capital themselves or only so much attention span. So everything that Stephanie is saying, absolutely, and then also what we do know, for example, some of the leaders in the Senate, they might focus on one area, but we want to make sure that they're not forgetting detention and voting against that.
Thanks, Denise. Any other questions for Stephanie or about lobbying? Anyone? Actually, I have a question for people on the call, not Ben, but are there some members on the phone who have done lobbying like this, have gone to town halls? Is there anyone there who could speak to that? No? Okay.
Well, I could. Oh. This is Bob Pearson from New Mexico.
Thanks, Bob.
But I live in a very remote area, and it's very rare that any of the politicians come to this area, even our representative. He has one of the largest districts in the country. It covers half of the fifth largest state. But when he has been here, he doesn't draw a big crowd. And I always have a chance to ask a question.
That's great. Are you through?
Yes.
Oh, okay. You cut off at the end. Thanks for sharing that, Bob. I really appreciate that.
This is Larry. I would just add another opportunity that's sort of like a town hall is keep your ears out for any time that there's going to be a talk show with your member of Congress. I've been able to speak to Cory Booker directly on WGBO.
Great.
I love it, Larry. That's awesome.
Okay. So if there are no further questions for Stephanie, let's move on to Larry. This is really important because this feeds into, you know, the situations that cause the Burks facilities and whatnot. I want him to speak about the Southern Triangle and
Northern Triangle.
Northern Triangle. Oops, sorry. All right, I misspoke. So, Larry, take it away.
Okay, I've been with Amnesty as a legislative coordinator since 2005 and as a country specialist since 2006. Before coming to Amnesty, I wrote a political science dissertation on the implementation of the Salvadoran Peace Accords with a focus on the role of human rights defenders and looking at the public security reform and attempts to demilitarize public security. Over the years, I've given expert testimony in dozens of asylum cases And I'm happy to say that last week, one of the cases I was working on, a gay Salvadoran received withholding, which means he isn't going to be deported. So that was a very important victory for at least one person. So I'm going to start off by talking about the threats from criminals that people in the Northern Triangle, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are facing. And then I'm going to move on to threats from the people who are supposed to be protecting them, their governments, their security forces. And I can also talk about specific groups that are in danger. All right, so the main criminal groups that everyone knows about are the gangs, the Madre Salvatrucha and the 18. There's also other organized criminal groups, and there's a lot of individual criminal violence, especially domestic violence directed against women. The region has incredibly high homicide rates. In 2015, El Salvador's homicide rate was 108 per 100,000. It dropped down to 81 per 100,000 in 2016, and the Salvadoran government thought this was a big deal. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, puts the U.S. homicide rate at 5 per 100,000. In addition to the people that are reported as being killed, there's also a large number of people that are reported as disappeared, missing. Sometimes these people have later turned up in large clandestine graves. In other cases, we don't know what happened to these people, and their relatives are just left in limbo wondering what happened to them. The criminals in El Salvador, especially the Maras, don't only kill people, they torture them to death. They bind their hands with rope or with razor wire, barbed wire. They slowly kill them. They beat them. They hack them with machetes. Their bodies are sometimes cut into several pieces, put into garbage bags or suitcases, and left in different areas to send a message, this is what happens when you mess with us. There's no freedom of movement in these countries. If you're in an area that's controlled by the Madre Salvatrucha, you can't go into an area controlled by the 18, or they'll assume that you're a spy and they'll kill you. The same thing goes on the other side of the gangs. Salvadorans, Guatemalans, Hondurans will sometimes have to walk for hours to get someplace that would only take 10 minutes because they have to avoid crossing gang lines. Children can't go to school where they're supposed to because it's in the wrong neighborhood controlled by a different gang. Employers won't hire you if you come from the wrong neighborhood because they are afraid of what the gangs are going to do. The governments try to deny it, but there are large numbers of internally displaced persons in these countries, people who've been uprooted by the gangs and sometimes by the security forces who haven't left the country, so that they're not refugees or asylum seekers, but they have had to leave their homes and go to other parts of the country. The gangs rely on extortion for most of their income, and that's not just focused on rich people, that's mainly focused on poor people, somebody who just has a soda stand, for example. They're making very little money, but they have to pay extortion to the gangs. A lot of young boys especially are forced to join the gangs. The gangs often think that if an 8-year-old kid goes around collecting extortion money, if he gets caught, he isn't going to go to prison, so they want to have that 8-year-old doing that. There's lots of sexual violence. Girls who are abducted by the gangs are basically turned into sexual slaves. And being a girlfriend of gang members is also, you know, is not something that you can just leave because you're being raped or you're being beaten, that if you leave, you die, essentially. Witnesses are in very grave danger. There is no protection from the police. Your only hope of protection is if you can hire bodyguards. And the prosecution overly relies on witnesses and not scientific evidence. So there's a high level of motivation to eliminate and kill witnesses. There are incredibly high levels of impunity. Very few cases make it to court. And in El Salvador, only 8.5% of those that make it to court result in convictions. There's no protection for returned migrants, and Amnesty's Home Sweet Home report, released in October, features a case of Sol from Honduras, for example, who was a bus driver who was targeted by the gangs and fled to Mexico. He was returned to Honduras, and 3 weeks later, he was murdered, and that happened actually just 3 days after Amnesty interviewed him for the report. Are there any questions about the criminal violence before I move on to the security forces? I guess not. All right. So, as I said, I wrote my dissertation on attempts to reform public security in El Salvador. Before the end of the war, the military was the only security force, was the only police in the whole country. And there was an attempt to get the military out of public security and create a new civilian police force. That got really messed up. The civilian police force became militarized and corrupt, and the military continued to have a strong direct role in public security. The governments of the region have engaged in what they call mano dura policies, iron fist policies, which are basically using brute force instead of investigating and finding out who is really responsible for crimes and punishing them, assuming that somebody who is a young male, who's poor, who lives in the wrong neighborhood, must be a gang member. Again, in the Home Sweet Home report, there is the case of Andres, a young Salvadoran who was accused of being a gang member by the Salvadoran military, and he was tortured. Basically, some of the torture that's described in the case is along the lines of waterboarding. This policy doesn't work, and it doesn't protect people from the maras, from the gangs. There's lots of corruption in the police force and in the military. The police are often involved in crime themselves, and sometimes they're either members of the gangs or working with the gangs. Crime victims are afraid to report any crimes. If you're a witness, you're going to be killed by the gangs or whoever else, your abusive partner. They don't believe the police will do anything about it, and the police may actually tell the gangs or your abusive husband that you reported them, and then you'll really be dead. The military's, the security forces, the police and the military are also involved in death squads, which ostensibly are supposed to be fighting crime and killing criminals. In many cases, however, they wind up doing things like armed bank robbery, murder for hire, extortion, etc. There has been a real increase in both the militarization of the security forces and the number of soldiers directly involved in public security. A few years ago, there was in El Salvador a case that came out in the media that really brought attention to this, the Finca San Blas massacre, in which this new elite police unit, militarized police unit, summarily executed captured gang members who weren't able to fight back, but also just killed off this Bible student who happened to work on the farm where the gang members were squatting. So, you know, you're not safe from them, and the government is actually a threat to you. Specifically, women are at a lot of risk. The maras are a big source of the violence against them, but there's also a lot of domestic violence, and the region has some of the highest femicide rates in the world. There is a special law in El Salvador to protect women and to prosecute the crime of femicide, but in practice, it doesn't really do anything. Amnesty has found a lot of bias against, on the part of the authorities, the police, the judges, other people, so that these laws protecting women aren't enforced. And in El Salvador, at least, if you get, if you're impregnated by being raped, you can't legally have an abortion. We just had an action on a young girl who was repeatedly raped by a gang member, and she didn't know she was pregnant, she had a miscarriage, and she's now serving 30 years in prison. The LGBT community is also at risk. They know that the police will not protect them, so the gangs see them as really great targets for extortion. They're often raped. The transgender community, transgender men and women in El Salvador have very few places where they're able to work that will accept them. And as a result, they're forced into sex work. And that is incredibly dangerous, so a lot of them are killed doing that. Also, with the increased involvement of the military and public security, the military is actually more hostile towards the LGBT community than the police. So that's making it worse. You can find out more information about these things in two great reports that Amnesty put out, Home Sweet Home in October, last October, and more recently in June, Facing Walls.
Okay, any questions for Larry?
Larry, this is Carolyn. What was the name of the second report that you just mentioned, Facing?
Facing Walls. The complete report, let me get that up. Why isn't my mouse responding? There we go. My computer isn't responding right. But, yeah, it's Facing Walls. Here we go. Facing Walls, USA and Mexico's violations of the rights of asylum seekers.
And there is, this is Denise, there's a dedicated website to it called facingwalls.org, which have actions targeting the U.S. government, Mexico, and the governments of the Northern Triangle.
Also, the Home Sweet Home website has a lot of has like about five really great videos of testimony by people who were featured in the report. There's, for example, an interview with a trans woman from El Salvador, Patricia, who was facing extortion from the gangs.
Great, thanks for that. Are there any other questions for Larry?
Yeah, so this is Ben, I guess. How do we talk about problems around military and civil police division? Is this, like, I understand that it's wrong on principle, but it's not something that I feel ready to discuss. On, like, why we need the change.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
Is this Kramer? Sorry. Okay, so the question that I wanted answered was, how do we talk about the problems between civil and military division and policing? Because I understand that there needs to be a boundary, but I don't really have the vocabulary to talk about the need for the boundary.
All right, we have to remember about human rights like due process. A lot of people will say, oh, well, you're concerned about due process. You're protecting the criminals or you're protecting the terrorists. But due process is essential for protecting the public from the criminals or the terrorist. If your strategy is to go out and say, that guy is a Muslim, he must be a terrorist, or that guy is poor and he lives in the wrong neighborhood, he must be a gang member, you're not going to be doing the research and building up the evidence to find and prosecute the people who are actually involved in crime. The military's role is going out and fighting people like another armed force or, in some cases, fighting terrorists. But the military's role isn't investigating crimes. The military is not trained to investigate crimes. The military is trained, basically, you know, it's their duty to kill people. That's their job. We could also see what happened in Ferguson, for example, where the military was brought out to put down public demonstrations. You know, it was totally inappropriate for that to happen.
Got that, Ben?
Yeah, thanks for that explanation.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, Ben, since we're here, why don't we swing over to you, and you can talk about some of the work you've been doing in Arizona.
Yeah, absolutely. So good evening, everybody. Again, I'm Ben from Arizona. Here, I'm the state legislative coordinator and have been in April in official capacity and, I guess, October-ish and working instead of someone else. So tonight I'm just going to go over a couple of different ways you can take action and how those go down. So I'll start with town halls. So last month I attended a town hall for Ruben Gallego, who is the representative for basically downtown Phoenix in our state. And so, again, I do want to reiterate, it's important to get there early and to go around and meet as many staffers as possible, as Stephanie was talking about. What I found is a lot of town halls nationwide have started moving away from live question asking to paper questions. And that shouldn't be all too scary. A lot of times I would recommend that people going to any town hall bring a couple of lines on an index card with your question to begin with. And so if it's a paper town hall, then that just means putting those couple of lines from your index card onto the common card your member of Congress is going to put in front of you. So once you're actually inside, you're going to be met usually by a couple of tables with constituent services, et cetera. Those are just places to go and connect with your staffers. Each of them generally has a business card, and their job is to be your voice up to the congressperson when they're not in town, especially. So those business cards are a good way for you to have someone who's going to be more likely to be able to take your email, et cetera, is what I found in my time as working as a legislative coordinator. Once you get inside, there have been a lot of people that have been very excited recently at these town halls, particularly over healthcare. So you'll find that you're surrounded by a lot of activists in general, at least that's been my experience, in the more progressive districts that surround my part of the country. So that brings us to kind of what Stephanie was going on when she was discussing protesting versus asking a question. So a lot of times you'll hear a lot of people either loud clapping, et cetera, which is a way to reinforce something you agree with, of course, but it also takes away from some of the ability of the town hall to proceed. And so generally it's something that we recommend against just because you don't want to be caught up in that. And it also just shows respect for continuing to proceed, and it allows you to get to your question faster. So once your question is being asked, it's time to take the mic and try and get through quickly, but remembering to hold your ground again so you can follow up. So when I asked specifically about a piece of legislation designed to end the executive order that created the Muslim ban, since it was a paper town hall, there wasn't a way to do a follow-up question, and so the difficulty there was we couldn't follow up with a question on, after he said he supported the concept of going against it, whether he would co-sponsor, which is a frequent request from Amnesty. So then for general drops or lobby visits for your first time, one of the most important things that I wasn't really thinking of the first couple of times I went was preparing the materials for your member of Congress. So one of the first things that I do now when I'm going to visit any office, especially, is I set up a folder, and in that I'll put Amnesty's lobby brief alongside any other materials that they've sent out for public use. And oftentimes you'll find that we'll send a lot of FAQs and things that you can use for your comments that won't necessarily be for the Congress people themselves. So obviously don't put those in. But then what also helps is to include your own statement. So I'll usually write a one-page letter This just includes some of my commentary that I'll be reiterating during the meeting if I have the time. If it's your first time, usually you'll be meeting with a staffer recently in our city, working with some very have been very different depending on the day that we've gone. So if there are a lot of protests, we've had some days that they're not all that willing to talk, which is part of why we bring our written statement now. But that's not about them with you. It's sometimes about them with other interactions. So it's important that we push through and always have a written statement to fall back on, especially if you don't have a scheduled lobby time and instead are just doing a drop-in visit. That's what I prepared. So, are there any questions on, starting legislative advocacy?
Hey Ben, this is Stephanie. I had a question about when you were doing a drop-off of the materials, was there any sort of security that you had to deal with, like getting in the building, or were you just able to sort of like walk into the office? Because I know it differs.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Arizona, all of our offices are relatively easily accessed, so there aren't security measures, except at Senator John McCain's office, you aren't allowed to bring in any backpacks or briefcases. So sometimes it's good to just carry in a folder or be ready to leave your bag at the door. Whatever that means for you.
Got it. Thank you, Ben.
Yes.
Another question for Ben?
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyone have comments, questions for anyone, Denise, Stephanie, Larry, or Ben?
Hi. I have a question. This is Ike Dimitriadis from New York.
Hi, Ike. Go ahead.
Hey. So my question is, recently I had gotten the opportunity to be part of a political action committee, and in some of the meetings, in all of the meetings, we have members of Congress come and they speak to the group. And there's an opportunity to speak, which is a format that's similar to town halls, but not exactly. The kind of questions you can ask are different. The way you present is different. My question is, in the context of town halls and legislative advocacy, does Amnesty have any strategy or anything with which members who have these opportunities can engage? In other words, is there any guidance? In a most recent meeting, I was in a meeting where Steny Hoyer was speaking, a Democrat from Maryland, and I had sent a note to my LC, and I'd gotten a list of questions back, and they were good questions, but they weren't really a fit for that kind of a meeting. So my question is there any guidance, is there any strategy around engaging people who have
This is Larry. I would be very careful with that because a political action committee is involved in electoral politics, and we have to make sure that Amnesty is presenting itself as a nonpartisan organization, that we aren't Democrats, we aren't Republicans, we don't support particular candidates, and PACs are specifically to support candidates. So I think we need to be very careful with something like that.
I agree, and that's one of the things that make it a little bit different from a town hall, not the least of which is you can't start your question with, hi, I'm an Amnesty member. You're a member of that committee, and you're asking as an individual. Nevertheless, it's an opportunity, and so if there was some way we could leverage that opportunity, that's where it gets a little sticky. So that's the question, right?
Yeah, Larry, thank you for taking that. Really good flags. And we can follow up if you email grassroots@aiusa.org, and we can speak a little bit more about, some concerns. But good question.
Will do. Thanks.
Thanks, Ike. I know you do a lot of good lobbying for us. Thanks. Any final questions? Final comments? Okay, so let's wrap this up. I really would like to take this opportunity to thank each of our wonderful speakers this evening for sharing their knowledge and their expertise with us. Denise Bell, Stephanie Malini, Larry Ledutke, and Ben Steele. And thanks, too, for all of you who called in and those who have called in again who are here each month. Thank you. And especially those who shared questions or comments. I hope you found the information really helpful. So remember that all the monthly calls are recorded and will be listed in the Activist Resource Community, which is ARC, on our website. And check the email today. Be sure to sign up for our lobby action. Share it if you can. Get as many people to participate as possible. We'll be pushing it in the next 2 months. So, again, click the link in the email that I sent out today. And I guess that's it. So please join us again next month. We really appreciate your support. So good evening, everybody. Thanks.
Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Ed.